Welcome to the Rights Track podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing us today. In Series 1, we talk to academics who have dedicated their research to the systematic analysis of human rights problems. In Series 2, we talk to human rights advocates and practitioners involved in the struggle for human rights to learn more about their work and the ways in which academic and other research helps them. I'm Todd Landman. In today's episode, we're asking what has been in the advance of gay rights, and how does the struggle for gay rights fit into the larger struggle for human rights? My guest is Richard Bevan, Director of Distribution at Swinton Insurance in Manchester, and trustee for Stonewall, a gay rights advocacy organization founded in 1989. Richard has previously worked for Lloyds Banking Group, Thomson Reuters, the Bank of New York Mellon, and the Northern Trust. So welcome, Richard. It's great to have you here on the Rights Track.
Thank you, Todd. An honor to be invited.
So we met a few years ago through a mutual connection. We've had some discussions both online and offline about the work that you've done, both within large organizations, some of the leadership work you've been doing, the work around the culture of large organizations, but also your work as a trustee for Stonewall. And I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the sort of success and the struggle for gay rights here in the United Kingdom. I've been a scholar of social movements for many years, and I study the gay rights movement here in the UK and the US. And so I'm really interested in your views about what do you think the major successes have been, some of the setbacks, and some of the challenges that the movement has faced.
There are many, many days where I think we've come an enormously long way. First and foremost, I guess, in changing laws, because you know, if laws are repressive, then people will be oppressive. If laws are open and welcoming and not oppressive, then I think we live in a very different, then it leads to a very different society and culture. And I think therefore things like, you know, repeal of the acts that Stonewall was set up to do, and much more recently, you know, the gay marriage bill being passed through Parliament is just a huge step forward, not just for the gay community, but in terms of our human rights overall. So there are legislative parts that I am very pleased to have seen and seen it happen in my lifetime. I think then there's a general sense of things like Pride, and not just London Pride, the Pride that now exists all around the UK, a celebration of diversity and inclusion that happens to be led mainly by the LGBT movement. But I think when you see it and you see Black Pride and things like that, it is about, for me, inclusivity. So there's lots of me thinking we've come a long way. And then there are times when I think, gosh, I wonder how much the progression we've made has been partly buried. Homophobic feelings, for example, or racist feelings are just buried because people don't think it's okay to say bad things. And then you have what we've just seen around Brexit and Trump's campaign and things like that, where you start to see what I think has been buried come to the surface, and people think it's okay to be racist because if, you know, the now becoming leader of the main powerhouse of the Western world, it's okay to be racist. Well, it's okay for me to be racist. And we saw lots of, you know, appalling racism in the Brexit campaign. And what we also saw was a significant rise in homophobic hate crime immediately after Brexit. And that's continuing. So good progress, and really, really pleasing and exciting progress for acceptance without exception, but it is still there, and I still think we have a long way to go.
Yeah, that's amazing. So, you know, in a lot of assessment about the success of social movements and movement politics, we break down success often in terms of the legislative institutional agenda, so the institution of civil partnership, marriage, access to equal rights, everything from being able to attend hospital to inheritance rights, insurance rights, all those sorts of things that are so crucial to loving couples around the world, and also the cultural side, so the awareness and the cultural acceptance, etc. And as someone who was new to this country over 20 years ago, I found that the whole cultural aspect was different. There was a different acceptability around a gay culture, I felt, certainly looking at some of the tradition in terms of the theater tradition, certainly in the panto tradition, was something I hadn't experienced before, this kind of playfulness and camp things that you see here in the UK. And then I wonder if that masked some of this under the surface homophobia and under the surface racism that you're talking about. And then I'm really interested in your linkages between between larger forms of discrimination, homophobia, racism, xenophobia, etc., is you see those sort of linked in many ways. And I'd like to explore that with you a bit. So you made reference to Brexit and the Trump election and that renaissance of racism and fear and some of the discourses that come with that. And you see those linked, you know, you see homophobia and racism linked. So I'm just curious where you see those linkages and what the inexorability are, you know, between them.
I read something, I think it was Plato, well, I'm not absolutely sure, you know, sort of 300 BC, talking about how do leaders get elected. And often when you have a population that's feeling hurt by things and perhaps not as educated as it needs to be, you can then literally stand up as a leader, lie a lot, but sound convincing. People then vote for it. And often those leaders use minority factions to create a false enemy. And therefore, for the mass of people, it feels quite good. And therefore, you know, the individual can get elected. So therefore, this picking on minorities, if you could describe it as that, is a common way for centuries of getting leaders elected. And I think it's now called the post-truth politics. It kind of doesn't matter what you say, as long as it sounds convincing that people will vote for you. So what's the easiest thing to do? Create a false enemy. That false enemy could be the Jews at one stage. It could be gays, it could be blacks, Asians, whatever, anything that you can make up to be a threat to you, therefore, and then you use that to come to power. And I think there's a lot of history of that. And I do think we've seen that resurgence across what we've seen in Europe and what we've seen in America very recently, which I think is particularly worrying. The history also seems to suggest that once those leaders get elected, they break the promises that they made to get elected. And very quickly, that causes social unrest because people feel they've been let down. And therefore, I suspect, again, why we're seeing some of the rise of some of the racism, some of the homophobia that we've seen is partly just people. And I think it will get slightly worse, frankly, because I think people will know quite quickly that, you know, they feel they've been lied to. And we've seen that in both countries.
That's really interesting. So there's this concept that political theorist Ernesto Laclau uses called the logic of equivalence. And this is a logic which allows that grouping together of quite disparate groups and calling them all the same thing. So the Nigel Farage poster of Britain at Breaking Point grouped all immigrants, whether you were an EU migrant, whether you were a non-EU migrant, whether you were illegal or legal or refugee, didn't matter. You were all part of the problem. And that sort of artificial grouping, if you will, that creation of the enemy, as you say, is a very effective rhetorical strategy and discursive strategy. And I dare say Donald Trump has done a similar thing in labeling Mexicans, illegal immigrants, Muslims, Syrian refugees, etc., all grouping them together as this sort of threat to the greatness of America. And it proves very effective. Now, what's really interesting, what you said, is that now they get elected. Farage did not get elected, but was successful at least in achieving the Brexit vote. And Trump has been elected, but we are seeing this rise. I mean, HMIC, which is Her Majesty's Constabulary, has released a report that there are up to 6,000 racist incidents in the UK between the sort of June referendum and today. So it's a really huge number. And we're looking at a sort of 40 to 45% increase in these incidents. And some of them are anti-disability, some of them are homophobic, xenophobic, etc. And so we know anecdotally these things are happening, but when we look at the aggregate statistics, it's quite shocking about this. The Southern Poverty Law Center in the United States is collecting statistics. Since just in the 10 days since the November 8th election, there were 867 events recorded by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Public spaces, private spaces, places of worship, primary, secondary schools, universities, a whole range of sites of struggle where we've been hearing this discourse. So it very much fits with what you've said there about this grouping together and then that disappointment after the election. And then all that stuff is now, you know, the genie's out of the bottle,
absolutely
right.
And I think the other thing I've seen, and I don't know whether it's statistically seeing yet, but actually within the minority groupings, I think they are also being pretty unpleasant towards each other. And I've seen more evidence of racism in the gay community towards other gays than I have ever seen. And I have plenty of Asian gay friends, and some of the appalling racist abuse I've seen towards them from other gays is shocking.
So that's really fascinating, right? Because there's an assumption, let's say, let's, for lack of a better word, on the liberal left, that all sort of minority groups have a common interest and therefore will get on with one another. And actually what you're saying is that there's internecine strife within the minority communities between gays of color and white gays, and, you know, a whole set of divisions there that we're not really thinking about.
Yeah, London Pride, for example, if you look at that and the optics there, you could say it looks like London White Pride. The Black Pride happens on another day, and you think, gosh, that doesn't feel or look right. But that's what happens. And I suspect if you're a black gay community, you'd feel that there are two prides going on here, one for the whites and one for the blacks, which again sort of reinforces that message of you may be all gay, but you're still black and white. It's quite interesting optically, that one, for me, that it doesn't feel inclusive. It feels there's inclusive if you're like me, but not entirely.
Yes, so there's similar divisions in the women's movement. There's a giant march being planned for Washington, D.C. on the 21st of January, and there's been some opposition to this among certain feminist groups. And there was an amazing blog in the U.K. from, I believe it was on the Verso Books website, about the inappropriateness of elite white feminism. So the elite white feminism of Hillary Clinton was inappropriate for the election in America, that it didn't actually reach out to poor women, didn't reach out to black poor women, it didn't reach out to the sorts of communities that should have been mobilized to vote, and that it was a very kind of particular form of feminism that works for a certain class of white women but doesn't work for a more sort of joined up mass movement of politics. And it sounds like it's similar things happening in the gay community as well.
It is, and I also think that there is a relevance of that point around that women's movement point you're just making, with this, you know, let's have more talented women in companies. And what often I've seen across a number of them is that very senior talented women are the role models, the rally cry to sort of be like me, I've made it, I'm on the board and I'm great. And I remember sitting at a meeting in one of the banks I work for, and this power dressed lovely woman was talking about, yeah, it's very difficult to have a work-life balance. And she said, I have to have two nannies to do this. And the lady sitting next to me, who ran one of our branches, said, I mean, this isn't talking to me. I'm not going to have two nannies. I can't afford to live, let alone two nannies. So that's not a role model to me. I don't feel inspired by that type of woman in business, because if I have to have two nannies to run my life, I don't want to be that successful. It was really interesting. And I think there's resonance to what you're saying about the Clinton view and who she appealing to and who is she not.
So interestingly, another layer of interpretation about the Trump vote in America and the Brexit vote here is this sense of alienated communities that have been left behind, just sort of issuing a protest vote. So if we go back to what you just said about large corporations, there are divisions within large corporations, because you have a whole continuum of staff members in any organization. And one of the things that's emerging, of course, are equality, diversity, and inclusion groups. There are a number of agendas in the academy and in business. And I'm curious, from your experiences in business, how active has business been in promoting equality, diversity, and inclusion?
I've worked for a number of very large organizations who I think have been trying very hard indeed to be much more inclusive. And I think at one end of the scale, it's a bit lip-servy and, oh gosh, we better be nice to the minority groups and show that we are and talk about it. Some go much further and much deeper and have all sorts of programs. So if I take a great example of Lloyds Banking Group, where I was, it is really becoming part of the DNA. I've just been to an event with them. I was invited back, and one of the exec of Lloyds Banking Group owns, for example, diversity and inclusion. And what she's done as a straight ally in the LGBT community, they produce videos from someone whose wife is bisexual. They're very open in what they're talking about and how they talk about the organization and why it matters. Others aren't. Where I'm coming from on this is I think it's about talent. So there's two bits of me. One is there should be equal rights for gays and we should be included and all that sort of stuff, which is part of what I do in organizations. This for me is a lot about talent and inclusivity. And I think that that's what it should be about, is how do we make sure that the most talented have the opportunity to get on and up in organizations. And I think some of the little groups that have been set up have made gays and other groups feel a bit better. Has it done the talent thing? No, I don't think it has yet. And if I give you an example of that from talking with Liz Bingham at EY. I mean, Liz is fantastic. She's done a huge amount. But they regularly relook at their programs. And they said, look, they've got this talent program to encourage women. And she'd say it's not been particularly successful. One is because everyone went on unconscious bias training, which everyone thought was a good idea 10 years ago. Basically, everyone now knows they're unconsciously biased. It doesn't change behavior. And then in the women thing, they did lots of training for women. So they took the women and trained them. The hindsight thing is why? Because the men now think it's a woman's problem. We've got to fix the women. Not it's a problem, and they are rethinking their entire strategy. So I do think these things need to be carefully thought through as to what they're trying to achieve. And if I look at my own industry of insurance, 1% of graduates would think about insurance as a place to work. And if you're LGBT, it's 0.1%. The whole industry seen as pale, male, stale, not exciting, not a place for me. Graduates join as openly gay graduates and go back into the closet when they join the insurance industry, which is still terrifying for me. So we've got a very long way to go to help organizations understand that this is about talent. And if you want the most talented people to come and join you, which we desperately need in insurance, you're going to have to see real change to the behaviors, to the leaders, to the industry. So there's another example that the British Insurance Brokers Association conference in Manchester last year, 90% probably straight, certainly white, certainly male, mostly middle-aged. It doesn't look like a welcoming place. It just looks like a bunch of blokes that all get together and have a conference.
So these are extraordinary set of observations. And someone made a point to me the other day where they said that, you know, if Kinsey is to be believed, then roughly one in 10 people is probably gay. Whether they're out or not doesn't matter. That's probably where the demographic sits. And yet in the representative organization for LGBTQ people, there's an undersubscription in membership. And the observation was, do these people not want to be part of the group? Do they feel like they don't need a group, that they're quite perfectly happy to be out of the closet, be gay, be openly gay, and let everyone know, but they don't feel like they need a group to represent their interests? Whole set of complexities around representation, identity, and choice, I suspect, that plays into some of these, either bottom-up or top-down initiatives to be inclusive, right? I don't know how you feel about that.
I think that's very valid. I think partly you've got, why do some people want to lead these minority groups? It becomes a little bit, for some of them, quite self-aggrandizement that, look, I'm leading the gay group in the organization. It gives people that are relative junior, often quite senior, access. So there's a little bit of someone does it for probably the wrong reasons. Not everyone, but some do. There are people who don't want to be associated with the groups for some of the reasons you said. I won't come to an event because it will basically out me. There's another one around, I happen to be gay because I happen to have sex with men, but that is not how I live my life. I am not going to define myself by my sexuality. I am going to define myself by my talent, my family, my this, that, and the other. So I don't want to be seen as part of this group of gays that then starts to define me as, oh, you're the gay person in insurance, as opposed to I'm the talented person, I'm the, you know, this and that, the other. I think there's also how people want to define themselves will stop people choosing to be declaring themselves or ticking boxes on the survey forms and things like that, because it's just not how they want to define themselves. Or groups that are neutral.
There's a certain essentialism there that somehow sexuality and the actual practices of sex define who we are, because you don't have people declaring they're heterosexual, right? Or that doesn't become a primary feature of identification. Although there's quite a lot of heterosexual assumption making in interrelationships and social interactions within the workplace, which are never spoken, right? There's a lot of unspoken assumptions. And language and discourse, body language, etc., is something that's very, very complex and has many layers to it.
You're right, and I think that becomes particularly challenging when it comes to the trans community, where whilst I think LGB has come a long way, B particularly recently, T hasn't. It is extraordinarily difficult still to be trans, particularly in the workplace. And partly it's an education. And, you know, I'd put myself in this camp. I have lots of trans friends now from which I've learned a great deal. But I think no one knows and everyone guesses. And it's particularly difficult if you've got colleagues at work going through a transition to even know what to say. So often that creates animosity because people feel that they're not being talked to. And often it's an education thing is, well, they're human beings, full stop. And they're going on a journey, but you just don't know what to say. You don't know how to have a conversation. And I think that is particularly difficult. So I think the work we're doing at Stonewall with the trans advisory group that's been set up very deliberately is to try and help understand what the trans community needs to help it. And therefore, what can we do to support trans people to be able to be themselves? A, it's eye-opening, but B, it's pretty upsetting what trans people go through, I have to say.
Yes, and I really like your focus on humanity, that there's this shared humanity, this shared human dignity that really ought to be the start of the conversation on a lot of these issues. So the one thing then I wanted to just sort of close things out a bit about your feelings about the future. So, you know, there has been a quite long struggle if we think about the civil rights movement, the human rights movement, the women's rights movement. There have been a number of achievements. You started by saying that there are a number of legal achievements. So if we had a legal scorecard, we'd be quite pleased with what that looks like. There's been a raise in awareness. There's the complexities that we've discussed in terms of identities and which has primacy over another and how people feel included, not included, where the connections are, etc. And then we've had a disruption. For whatever reason, we've had a mobilization of bias, if you will. Two big electoral events, a possible another couple in France and Germany next year, possibly, where there's a kind of popular reaction to some of the progress that's been made around multiculturalism, around gay rights, around all these sorts of this swirl of issues. But so when you get up every day, are you hopeful about the future? Do you think this is a temporary setback, if you will, that we need to do something different in terms of reminding people of the progress that's been made and the challenges associated with that? How are you feeling at the moment for the short to medium term?
I do feel hopeful because I guess the hope for me comes through my own children, for example, where they don't see the world like some of the people who are being racist and homophobic at all. They just don't understand why people say and do those things. Maybe because they've been brought up in a pretty liberal environment, or maybe that's just the way they think now. I think what was really interesting at the weekend when we had the Stonewall Laces campaign at football matches up and down the country, which was hugely supported, tweeted, reached millions around the world, because obviously Premier Football does have an enormous reach. When you looked at the Twitter feeds, lots and lots of positives, and then horrible trolls and terrible words. But what encouraged me in a slightly bizarre way is after almost all of the trolling, negative, unpleasant, then someone followed it up with a positive comment. So it wasn't just left hanging at the bad point. Someone is following up saying, that's an unacceptable thing to say. And I was lucky enough to be at Manchester United on Sunday at their game, listening to what the club is trying to do. It's done a lot around racism. It knows there's more to do on diversity and inclusion, and it is really trying. So I think if we see the roots of this, so such as the work that we're doing in schools, making a difference, because a lot of it starts there. If we can do things in football, which is such an influential sport, to start to change hearts and minds. And I think also internationally, for all the good stuff we have here, when I look around the world, there's still horrible things going on in Africa, and it's illegal to be gay in Singapore, etc. There's a lot to do around the world, but you can't fix everything. My view is, let's keep going. I am pretty positive. I think what we've got is a blip, and probably people genuinely feeling unhappy about a lot of things. Hence, we've seen this upswing in bad behavior, but I'm pretty positive this will counterbalance at some point. I don't know when.
Well, I think that's a really wonderful assessment. And I like this idea of looking for points of leverage, looking for those entry points where we can make a difference, certainly through sport, through schools. You know, and the young people today have grown up in an environment in which there's diversity and difference around them every day in their everyday interactions. So it's nice to end on that message of hope. And it's really great, you know, all the work that you're doing within the organization, within Stonewall, but also in your professional life, in your private life, etc. So it just leaves me to thank you very much for joining me today, Richard. And I'm feeling good about what we just discussed. I think it's a good note to end on. So thanks for being on this episode of The Rights Track.
And thanks very much indeed for inviting me.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. Series 2 of the podcast is funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. More information, including all the podcast episodes from Series 1 and accompanying show notes for each of our interviews, is available on our website at www.rightstrack.org.